Good morning. This is Talking Animals. My guest today will be Michelle Nagelschneider, veteran cat behaviorist and author of the just-published book, The Cat Whisperer, Why Cats Do What They Do and How to Get Them to Do What You Want. We'll speak with her in a few moments. Later in our program, we'll talk briefly with Linda Hamilton, executive director of the Animal Coalition of Tampa, which is holding its annual Spaghetti and No Balls dinner on March 30th. Also, as the prize for Name That Animal Tune, we'll give away a copy of Michelle Nagelschneider's book, The Cat Whisperer. Right now, though, let's kick off the show with an animal tune of sorts. This is the Hollywood Flames with Buzz, Buzz, Buzz here on Talking Animals. That was the Hollywood Flames with Buzz, Buzz, Buzz. I'm Duncan Strauss. This is Talking Animals. My guest today, Michelle Nagelschneider, is a veteran cat behaviorist who in 1999 founded the Cat Behavior Clinic, a consulting service that helps people worldwide solve behavioral problems and other issues with their cats. She is also the author of the new book, The Cat Whisperer, Why Cats Do What They Do and How to Get Them to Do What You Want. So, with a reminder that we invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663 or emailing us at dj@wmnf.org. Let's welcome Michelle Nagelschneider to Talking Animals. Good morning, Michelle.
Good morning. Glad to be here.
Thank you so much for joining us. And again, we're speaking to you from the great Pacific Northwest, so it's very earlier time. So thank you so much for all the more for joining us this morning on Talking Animals.
No worries.
So, not surprisingly, perhaps, I'm eager to talk cats. I have lots of questions about cats. I've been asked to pose some questions to you about cats, and I'm sure some folks will call in with questions about cats. But sort of first things first, let's find out a bit about you. Tell us about your formative years, particularly as it pertains to animals.
Well, growing up, I guess like so many people growing up on a farm, we had every animal, but of course I didn't have a pet cat. We had feral cats that I was pointed out to that I needed to befriend if I wanted to have a pet cat. So they were kind of the evasive, unicorn, or we called them Cheshires because they would disappear so easily. So I spent a lot of years just trying to, you know, socialize, I guess you could say.
And these were barn cats, Michelle, or?
Yeah, yeah, barn cats, and then we had a canyon behind our home.
Okay.
That, you know, they would hide back there, and I spent every day out in the summer, you know, 4 years old, trying to befriend these cats. And then fast forward, 20 years ago, I worked as a vet technician, and you know, knew I always wanted to do something with animals, and you know, people wanted help with their cat behavior issues. And back then, there really wasn't anything out there for cats. It was just dogs. So, you know, they were using dog behavior on their cats, you know.
Sure.
Disastrous nuclear results. So, and yeah.
Yeah.
About 14 years ago, I actually opened, you know, the cat behavior clinic. We have Dr. Schultz, who's a vet who also works there. I'm doing consults, and we do them everywhere now, all over the world. Greece, Malaysia, India, you know, everywhere. Cat lovers everywhere. Cat problems everywhere, too.
Sure.
You know, that we deem problems, but of course, it's just cats behaving like cats would, you know,
yeah.
The environment we've given them.
Well, I definitely want to delve deeply into those kinds of things and some of the stuff that you cover in the new book. And but let me ask you this: this might go back to the ferals and the barn cats we just talked about. But what's your sort of very first memory of a cat?
Probably the cats in the canyon, hiding mm-hmm. behind the rocks and the bushes. And I almost thought, you know, when I was so young, 4 years old. Or 3 years old, that they almost weren't real. You know, they would disappear so quickly, and that was probably my very first memory.
And so back then, when there were these elusive cats in the barn and in the canyon, I mean, did you nonetheless just feel some sort of, you know, instant love connection or kinship? I mean, has it always sort of been about cats for you?
Well, I grew up with dogs, really. I mean, mm-hmm. I was a big dog person, like you hear so often. I grew up with dogs. It's so true.
Yeah.
Horses, all of that. And I, you know, as a young child, I would pretend, you know, I was an animal. And I thought I did really well at pretending I was a cat. It seemed like and then I learned this when I studied animal cognition. You know, it's really important to look at the world. You know, if you want to help an animal with their behaviors, you need to look at the world through their eyes.
Sure.
And I would try and do that. You know, where is this cat going to go? And, you know, where is it off to? And, you know, you would try and get in the mind of the cat. And in my book, I talk about that. Speculative tracking, Lewis Liebenberger, and they call it mind throwing. And so some anthropologists now believe that we instinctively can read animals well, you know?
So for
part
sure.
Of us, who we are.
Yeah. So along that path, Michelle, you know, was there a light bulb moment, though, of, hey, you know, I grew up with dogs and I, you know, lived on a farm and there was all these kind of animals floating around, but I'm going to work with cats because, you know, that's what I should be doing. That's maybe even my calling. Was there, you know, sort of a transcendent moment like that?
Yeah, there was a moment, again, about 22 years ago, working with the vets. I got so many calls from people. You know, I had a call from one woman in a Humane Society parking lot crying about ready to give up her cat. And I had to actually quit my job working as a vet tech,
yeah.
You know, because I had to choose, because it really ended up being a race to save cats' lives. You know, it wasn't just creating a business. It just kind of happened that way. The stepping stones, you know, were just placed in front of you.
Yeah. Wow. So just that was that moment. It's like, hey,
yeah.
I'm peeling off in this direction.
Yeah. And back then, you know, I don't know half as much of what I do now. And so it was really a race for me to learn everything I could. And I would, you know, I don't even think there was online back then.
Yeah.
So,
right.
You know, it was a lot of experiential work and, I did my best, you know, and
sure.
I got pretty good at it back then. But, yeah, it was a lot of, you know, and there wasn't really anything out there. There's a lot of dog behavior books, but not much out there for cats at all, really.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah.
I'm hoping people will get something out of my book. You know, I think there's a lot of good new information in there, too. And so many of these behavior issues can be solved, you know.
Yeah. Well, I have to say, as a lifelong cat guy, I certainly, you know, definitely learned all kinds of things along the way reading your book, and some of which I, again, hope to get into. Let's just let folks know this is Talking Animals. If you just tuned in, I'm speaking with cat behaviorist Michelle Nagel-Schneider, whose new book is The Cat Whisperer, Why Cats Do What They Do and How to Get Them to Do What You Want. If you'd like to ask Michelle a question about your cat or something going on in your home with your cat or cats, or offer just a general comment, please call 813-239-9663 or email dj@wmnf.org. So, yeah, so again, your book is just chock full of information and strategies for recognizing and correcting behaviors and issues. And I'm sure, again, we're going to talk about some of those as our conversation proceeds. But it kind of feels essential to right now to discuss the litter box. I mean, it just seems so hugely important in so many ways, including, you know, where you note that sort of unwanted elimination and problems with that, which, you know, basically involve litter box, you know, problems, is sort of the number one complaint of cat owners and the number one reason that cats are surrendered to shelters each year. So it's, you know, it couldn't be more important, really. So let's talk a little bit about guidelines, starting with numbers. Walk us through your recommended box to cat and really box to level of the house where it pertains ratio and why that ratio exists.
Yeah, that is the biggest, the most common consult that I conduct is definitely the litter box, urine being the bigger one. Defecation outside of the box, there's a few special things to know about that. Very different usually why they do that when it's just defecation outside of the box. But litter box number, you know, and I picked this up through all the years of reading books, generally we say one box for each cat plus one more. So if you have a three-cat household, you would have four boxes. And that's a general guideline. It's not that you have to have that, but and it's not so much the number. I mean, the number is important, but the location is important. So out in nature, you know, and again, this is what I help my clients think about, is that out in nature, they don't all the cats outside don't share, you know, a latrine site on 3rd and Maple. I mean, they have latrine sites everywhere,
sure.
You know, northeast, southwest. So we want to create something like that in the home because when cats move into social maturity, they begin looking at their environment through a territorial lens and want to structure their social hierarchy. So they'll timeshare everything, you know, food areas, hunting grounds, latrine sites. And so, you know, you can have all of your litter boxes, the correct number of litter boxes in your laundry room, but then you get to a cat that's moving into social maturity between the ages of 2 and 4 years, and it, all of a sudden, you know, they decide to carve out their own litter box resource under the dining room table, something like that.
Right. Not where it's intended, for sure. So, I mean, I posted a few things on Facebook about your being a guest this morning, and, you know, just, I mean, there was all kinds of interest and comments, but a lot of them seem to revolve around litter box chatter. In fact, one Facebook friend who actually runs a sanctuary that houses, you know, sort of a huge variety of animals, including a slew of cats, asked why some cats won't use litter boxes in their cat house. Now, again, they have a kind of an unusually large number of cats, but is it strictly the things you've already addressed that maybe there aren't either enough boxes or where they're placed to that would help explain sort of why some of these cats just aren't using the box?
Yeah, and we always tell everyone, you know, of course, go to your vet. We see a lot of urinary health issues, of course, you know, that haven't been caught. A lot of things will fly under the radar with the diagnostic tests, even at the vet. So sometimes, you know, you need to go back and really make sure that everything's okay. So we see a ton of that. But then, of course, you know, you can remedy that problem, and then you'll have these habituated behaviors left over, and, you know, you need to deal with the unwanted behavior and where that's happening. But a box that isn't clean enough, sometimes if the box is too clean, doesn't smell enough like urine or stool, you know, cat really won't be drawn to it. But generally we say, you know, cleaning the box, you need to sweep it a couple times a day. Cats cannot see in total darkness. That's a misconception too, or myth, and they have to have a little bit of light to see well in low light. So of course we always say add light. You know, sometimes that can make the biggest difference with my consults, even when I would think it wouldn't make any difference at all. You know, I'm always learning, and you know, lo and behold, that can make a huge difference. Covered boxes, you know, where in nature, you know, would we see a cat urine and defecate in a hollowed out log? I suppose they would, but generally they like that good escape potential, you know, in case a predator or a competitor cat came along.
Sure.
There's some food-based litters out there now that are corn or wheat litters. And again, you know, instinctively, when are they going to choose food to urinate and defecate in? You know, something that smells like food.
Yeah.
So we try and say stay away from those types of litters too. And then that social tension, going back to intercat social issues, you know, not feeling comfortable maybe a less assertive cat doesn't want to make its way all the way down to the basement, you know, at 9 a.m. because so-and-so's on the way there, you know, going to bop them on the head with their paw. And,
right.
And so that's where we create what we call land of plenty with the boxes.
Upstairs, sure.
Downstairs, northeast, southwest. Covered boxes, too few boxes.
Right. And even one of the things that I learned, among others, in your book on this issue is sort of related to what you said about the covered boxes thing is that even, I mean, I think we actually hit the ratio and then some, but at least one or two of ours is against a wall of some kind. And so I noticed that you pointed out, hey, that's not a great idea either, because, again, the cats want to look around and make sure that they're, you know, safe and can kind of keep an eye on things. So I've even tried to make a few adjustments. Just since finishing your book in that regard.
Yeah, and just, you know, every cat's a little bit different.
Yeah.
Some do like a more hidden box, more, you know, we think privacy maybe, but...
Sure.
And then other cats like, yes, that good beeline out the door, good escape potential, they're not going to get trapped. So I always say do a variety. You know, you can have some boxes, you know, hidden, some out in the open. You know, and if you like covered boxes... You know, I always say try and have some uncovered.
Sure.
Or, you know, if it means having a box in your living room and you really don't want one there, you know, I would say, well, that would be the one box I would allow you to have a covered box.
Right, right.
And they have some great cabinet litter box, you know, nice looking cabinets that look like pieces of furniture. I've had clients turn vintage chests, you know, into a litter box cabinet.
Wow, fancy.
Piece of furniture.
Nice. All right. Well, not surprising, Michelle. We've got all kinds of phone lines lit up, so we're just randomly here. We're going to take a call or two and see what questions we have. Hi, you're on Talking Animals with Michelle Nagelschneider.
Yeah, hello.
Hi, it's you.
My name's Joe. I'm from Tarpon Springs.
Hi, Joe.
Hey. I got two questions. You could just pick one if you want. One is easy. We work on our cats with different... We have five, and they vomit a lot, and we try different foods recommended by the vet, and we wonder if it's psychological, and I don't know if you can talk about that. The other one that my wife wanted me to ask you about is we have a really cute kitten. She's a Duluth Tortie, and she's really fun. She's an awesome little cat, but she whines and complains when we hold her, and we know how to hold a cat right, you know, support them and hold them sideways and all that, but she just fusses and whines, and what's so cute is she'll get in a little box, like a shoebox. You can pick her up in the shoebox and carry her around and pet her, and she's fine. But if you hold her in your arms, she just fusses and whines. And I was wondering if you know any way to break her of that habit.
Yeah. Oh, gosh. I would love to answer both of those questions. I get a lot of both of those. The vomiting, though, of course, you know, the first thing I would feel remiss if I didn't say was probably make sure they're healthy and all that, which I'm, you know, sure they are. But, you know, going to having a vet visit might be in order. With the kittens, that's really common for some kittens. I think just they're young, they're squirmy. But then, of course, socialization. If the kitten wasn't picked up, you know, 10 times a day between the age of 2 and 7 weeks, when all that socialization, you know, what happens to them between 2 and 7 weeks is so important. They might not like to be picked up as much or at all. What we do then for these, I like the idea of you picking the kitten up in the box, you know, that could lead to being more comfortable being picked up off the ground, but you could, and we did this with our recent cat that we adopted that was 5 months old. He didn't like to be picked up either. So we just retrain their little cat brains into thinking, you know, everything's okay. They don't get upset or worried when you pick them up. And so before she actually squirms to be put down, you want to put her down, so which might just be 1 second. You kind of lift her up off the ground a few inches and put her right back down. So we call that working at sub-threshold stress level. So in her mind, she doesn't remember that every time she gets picked up, it's this negative, you know, I want to get down. Or, you know, I'm feeling, you know, whatever she's feeling, claustrophobic, just not used to it. But chances are she gets older, you know, probably she might like to be held, you know. But right now you just want to put her down before she asks to be put down, and then you can up the ante a little bit every, you know, several days, you know, pick her, you could probably hold her for a little bit longer. If you had a wanded toy, you know, feather on the end of the string, something like that in the right hand, and you were holding her in your left hand, you might be able to distract her and keep her mood and emotional state out of that maybe red zone if she might be fearful. And so if you can get them to display that animated play, that mood and emotional state is independently controlled from fear. So and you can actually help her feel like, ah, oh, this is a positive thing. When I get picked up, this little bird flies around, and, you know, of course you don't want to get scratched, so be careful. But I would try those things. And,
cool.
And probably as she gets older, you know, she might enjoy it more. Kittens just want to run and play. And how old is she?
She's about a year.
Oh, okay. So you have more of a juvenile. Okay.
And she's pretty small, too. She's very petite. And I've been trying to hold her a little longer than she wants. But maybe I'll try the other suggestion you have. I also found if I pet her on the back, like most adult cats like, she hates that. But if I pet her on the head, it's kind of like your idea with the toy. She seems to tolerate me more.
Okay, Joe, I appreciate your call, but we have other callers with questions, and I've got questions, so I'm going to move on. But thank you so much.
Beautiful. Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
Excellent. Thank you.
Hi, you're on Talking Animals with Michelle Nagelschneider.
Is that me this time?
Yes, that's you.
Okay. I've had cats all my life as a child, and now we've been married almost 61 years, and we have a cat, unfortunately, who had anal gland problems. And for a long time, all those years, she was born in 2004, and we had her anal glands expressed every about 6 weeks or so. And last year, in the end of November, we had the anal glands removed. And I'm sorry to say it was a mistake, because now she is incontinent sometimes, and she gets things on the carpet, and at my age, it's too hard to clean up after her, and my husband's age as well. So we were advised to have her put down, which is very, very difficult to do. I don't know what the alternative. Have you ever heard about problems after they have their anal glands removed?
Yes, I did. I had a consult just yesterday. And it's hard to know for sure what's going on in there. Maybe, you know, a number of things. I mean, it could be their scar tissue and it's painful. A cyst and something, you know, that's where your vet, maybe try a different vet if that's what your original vet is telling you. You know, if there's pain going on, maybe ask your vet to address the pain. There's things there, you know, that we can see if there's...
No, I don't think it's pain, to be honest with you. I really know my cats.
Mm-hmm,
And because she just seems to have some kind of residue after she has a bowel movement. The bowel movement can be very firm, and then there's a residue of a little something soft. And it's like the sphincter doesn't close tightly. That's all, which could cause the incontinence. You know what I'm talking about?
That does, if I can just interject, that does sound probably like more of a question for a veterinarian than a behaviorist. Yeah,
that does
sound
more physical. But I will tell you this, and this is the little secret, you know, if you ever get a chance to peruse the clinic website, that when cats are just pooping outside of the box, that's a little key component there. Why is it just pooping? Why isn't it just urine? And so there's usually a reason, and a lot of what we see are impacted anal glands, anal gland issues, but stool that is too firm. And a lot of people think their cat's stool is normal, but if you see any segmented pieces, we call them fecal balls or a child's drawing of a caterpillar, the cat's stool is lacking in moisture, and that their lining in their colon is very tender, and it will cause this discomfort when, you know, pooping, and so they'll associate with pooping in the box as a negative thing. So, you know, adding moisture to the diet, talking to your vet about ways to soften the stool, that usually, and here's the anomaly about the defecation consult, is once you address maybe too firm of a stool, and again, I'm only speculating if that's the problem, they usually go back in the box like nothing was ever wrong once you address that.
Thanks for your call.
Thank you.
So this is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss. My guest is Michelle Nagelschneider, whose new book is The Cat Whisperer, Why Cats Do What They Do and How to Get Them to Do What You Want. We invite you to join the conversation, and some of our listeners have already, by calling 813-239-9663 or emailing dj@wmnf.org. So, Michelle, I mean, you make clear in the book that darn near everything pivots on how extremely territorial cats are. Tell us, you know, maybe just explain for listeners having a chance to read the book, you know, why that trait is so towering in cats, why that really does kind of dictate virtually everything.
Yeah, and a lot of people will think immediately, oh, that means aggression. It's a way to keep the peace. You know, cats are hazard avoiders. They don't want to fight out in the wild. You know, it is, you know, a survival, and it is a way that they structure their social hierarchy and survival out in the wild. So we call it a spatiotemporal dominance hierarchy, and their ranking fluctuates. You don't have an alpha cat, or even really one high-ranking cat. You could have a more dominant cat, but they will timeshare hunting ground. And so inside cats, you know, they'll timeshare different areas inside the home. So when one cat is at the top of the cat tree or at the food bowl at 9 a.m., they are the high-ranking cat at that particular location. If you have another cat come along to the food area at noon, they're a high-ranking cat in that area. So that's why we preach the land of plenty, you know, to decrease territorial thinking.
Yeah.
There's not enough things to go around. If the food location is scarce, you know, you have 10 food bowls in the kitchen, you know, it's still one location, and then you'll have friction. Not necessarily in the kitchen, but sometimes later throughout the day, one cat might say, you know, you went into the kitchen too many times, and now I'm going to beat you up, you know, later today. So
right, but so but even beyond that, it just seems like from what your book explains, I mean, the territorial nature and strong territorial nature of cats does affect so many other things, including, like, you know, the rap against cats, among others, is that they're solitary and antisocial. But you kind of note that really it's kind of the self-reliant nature linked to that territoriality that's not found in other animals that has as much to do with that as sort of, hey, these guys are just don't need us, and they just kind of hang on their own, and they're kind of, you know.
Right. Well, they're more territorial than dogs, and I think because they're not pack animals, and so they do have to survive really well on their own. And in order to do that, you know, protect their surroundings and become territorial, you know, hazard avoid back and forth between the different areas out in nature.
Yeah.
So I think that's really kind of the root reason.
Yeah, I mean, that you know, as part of this, to me, you know, it made sense, but I just hadn't thought of it in the terms that you'd put it, that you know, feral cats fight each other, you know, way less. I mean, again, presumably because there's you know, less of the territorial thing going on than house cats do. So,
right. And if you think about it, we're keeping them in captivity together.
Yeah.
Which is kind of a natural, if you think about it.
Sure.
You know? And then we force them to all eat in the same area, have the same latrine sites, and of course we're going to have fighting. But some cats are not as territorial as others.
Right, so they won't have
They'll
as much.
They'll need a lot more space.
Right, right. All right, let's take another call or two. Hi, you're on Talking Animals with Michelle Nagelschneider.
Hi.
Hi.
Hello.
I guess it's kind of a combo question, but I have five cats, like the previous caller, and taking into account all your advice, of which I'm going to do as far as getting more litter boxes and spacing them out, I'm having trouble with a couple of my little boys. They're about 3 years old. They're the more aggressive ones. I have three more docile cats. And is there one of them? I think both of them are urinating in inappropriate places. Like today I found some urine on the kitchen counter, and I cannot abide by that. My question is there a difference? Are they doing that because of a litter box thing or a territory thing? And my other part is that an aggression thing? Is there a difference between aggressive spraying and urination?
Gosh, it's hard to tell for sure when it's on the counter. Some cats, well, is it up against the backsplash, like maybe they vertically marked and then it dripped down, or was it more in the middle?
No, it was presented right in the middle of like on a plate.
Okay.
They have done that where they've sprayed onto like a dish towel in the bathroom, and it's ramped up in recent weeks, and that's why we're getting, and we got a vet appointment on Friday and all that stuff, but to rule out UTIs, but.
Yeah, we see a lot of smooth surface or cooler surface urination if there's a urinary issue, you know, urinary health issue, so it's good you're taking them in. How old are they?
I think they're about 3 years old now.
Okay. So in between 2 and 4, that's when you'll see the marking begin, the vertical marking. The number one reason for that is if they see an outside cat through a window, even if it's once a week all the way across the street in the neighbor's driveway. So you have to work on that, of course. That can also cause tension with your cats inside the home. That can actually be the root cause for intercat social issues, is that you know, worry that's created when they become aware of outside cats.
Yeah.
So you always want to make sure you get that out of the way. But it could just be plain old inappropriate urination on the counter. I think when it's high up on a counter, there could be some fighting that maybe occurred, and one cat is trying to get up and away from another cat and has to urinate. Is it in the morning that you're finding it?
Yes.
Yeah. So the outside cats come between 3 and 5 in the morning, and then do you hear fighting between your cats inside the home?
Occasionally, yeah.
In the morning? Yeah, so it could be that, you know, someone is fighting, upset, and they're urinating in that location. They don't feel safe going to the litter box. You know, urinary health issue. I wouldn't call that. They can horizontally mark. They can squat and urinate, but generally it's a smaller amount. It's not like a full-blown, you know, whatever's in their bladder. So it sounds like inappropriate urination. So, again, increasing the litter box numbers. If your cats don't have and location. If your cats don't have a strong group scent, if you don't have what we call a social facilitator cat, that cat is the one that walks around and grooms everybody, transporting scents all around between the cats. That spells trouble if you don't have a group scent, and that will lead to fighting and stress between cats. It's the social glue of the multi-cat household, so make sure they have a nice, strong group scent, and you can do that. You can become the social facilitator cat yourself and brush them 2 to 3 times a day with the same brush back and forth to create the group scent, and that can actually, we get emails every day full of exclamation points that in 3 days their cats are getting along better with that group scent technique.
Sure.
But make sure you use a good cleaner to get rid of that urine smell, you know, or that will draw them back too.
Okay, thanks so much for your call. We do need to move on.
Thanks so much.
Yeah. So Michelle, what you were just explaining to the caller there reminds me, we don't have time to get into all the details, but among the many things that I just learned about, even though I felt like I knew a lot about cats and multi-cat households, was introductions, like introducing a new cat to the household, and some of what you just mentioned to that caller reminded me that it's even if you know enough to like have rooms and introduce, you know, the old cat to the new cats or multiples or whatever, it's so much about the scent, the smell, and can you just talk at least briefly about that? Obviously, we don't have time to get into the technique, but it's just so important how crucial that really is in the process.
Yeah, the behavior plan for introducing, it's like an hour and a half consult, but yeah, briefly, we, you know, really slowly, you know, gently introduce the cats together, and we start with scent. It's very non-confrontational, non-threatening, you know, versus them seeing each other and smelling each other at the same time. So we work on creating that group scent, which is, again, that social glue. That's how they primarily relate in their environment, is through scent and knowing, you know, who's the invader, the intruder, and who's, you know, of their one of their associates. So creating that group scent and maintaining it until you see the cats themselves are finally maintaining the group scent every day and rubbing up against each other, and maybe one cat's grooming the other, something like that, and just gradually introducing them together. And again, I think I mentioned earlier, sub-threshold stress levels where we're not pushing fear buttons. You know, they're not 3 feet apart. They're not in swatting distance in the beginning. It's a lot of short sessions where they see each other 25 feet apart that end on a positive or neutral note. You don't want to wait until someone gets upset, because that will get filed away in their memory, and they'll remember, oh, every time I see that cat, something negative happens. So it's a lot of opposite of what you read online. It's really very gentle, you know, non-threatening exposure, and it can be a long process with many cats introducing them.
Again, this is Talking Animals. We're just sort of in the final few minutes of speaking with Michelle Nagelschneider, whose new book is The Cat Whisperer, Why Cats Do What They Do and How to Get Them to Do What You Want. And again, we've sort of been addressing some of the many, many cool sort of techniques and strategies that she offers in her book. And let me, I guess, kind of a ridiculous rhetorical question about cat siblings, because I can only just assume they're as different as human siblings can be. But among our cats at our house, we have two brothers that couldn't be more different. I mean, one is like loud, annoying, dopey, ultra needy, always trying to bust out of a screen patio. I mean, just all kinds of things. And his brother is like smart, quiet, dignified, elegant. I mean, is that, again, just sort of the way human siblings and other siblings just can be so strikingly different, or is there anything that else that you know, either in their development or other things that would account for such sharp contrast?
And this is a good question, and a lot of people say this is so odd, but if you look at a litter of kittens, you know, you have five kittens. One is always seems to be on the end of the spectrum of timid and kind of sits back and watches all the other cats play, and then you have the another cat on the opposite end of the spectrum that's very boisterous and more dominant behaving, and then there's the middle of the road cats that don't really stand out that much. They're more similar, and it seems that those cats on either end of the spectrum, they can have more behavior issues growing up, or what we deem behavior issues.
Yeah.
You know, too aggressive of a cat or too boisterous or gregarious or whatever.
Sure.
And then the timid cat that maybe gets picked on more by other cats. But no, I think that's just a natural development. I suppose something could have gone awry in socialization where maybe he was, you know, something scary happened and now he's just a little bit more timid than the other cat, or
yeah, well, and also too, and you and you devote a whole sort of section to this as well. But one of these, the one that obviously wasn't described as favorably, also is like a loud, constant meower. And but as far as we know, you know, in good health, no physical or medical things that would account for that. And again, just could not be more different than his brother in that way. And just seems really, you know, again, having grown up and lived with a lot of cats over a lot of years, it's just really this guy is just quite striking, really. So.
Well, a lot of cat owners end up reinforcing that meowing behavior. You know, they try and do something like, what do you want? Do you want food? Do you want to go outside?
Yeah.
You know, what do you need? And then they like meowing because it feels good. You know, it's been so closely associated with the reward. The
sure.
one to just meow and meow.
That worked last time, so why not do it again, right? Yeah.
We do see a lot of cat owners, and this is something that I, you know, it's a little bit different with, you know, all the cat households out there, but a lot of people space their cats feeding, you know, 10 to 12 hours apart, and cats have evolved to eat more frequently, and so we see a lot of issues, aggressive, not as cooperative cats if they're fed that far apart, so we always try and get our cat owners to increase the frequency, you know, don't have to feed them more calories, but, you know, smaller, more frequent meals throughout the day.
Right, right. Well, so, Michelle, we're sort of at the end of our time, but, you know, we've spoken on this show several times over the years about declawing, including a few conversations with the veterinarian who founded the PAW Project. But to me, it's just such crucial information and important to repeat and underline. Maybe in just remaining, we have maybe a minute or less, maybe you could just describe what declawing actually is and what it means for the cats who undergo that procedure.
Right, and I have a section dedicated to this in the book.
Yeah, you sure do, and it's really good. Yeah,
it's kind of disturbing, actually. I've gotten a few. That was very disturbing, but I really wanted to paint the picture, you know, of what I witnessed working at the vet 20-some years ago and
yeah.
how awful it was. And here I was only 20 years old. You know, I was listening to what the vets told me, and, oh, it's not that big of a deal, you know. But, yeah, you're amputating the first joint, and painful, of course, and some of these don't heal well and can cause even more problems. But the real thing I say is that clawing behavior can be directed to the areas that we want. They, you know, you don't have to declaw these little house cats. You know, I look at the wildcat sanctuaries with bobcats and lynxes and all the huge damage that they do. Then we've got this little house cat, you know, that we're just worried about our furniture getting scratched up. You know, it's very sad. It's
yeah.
very sad. And I hope it's banned, you know, everywhere.
Yeah. Right. Well, it is in a lot of countries and in different parts of this country. And just to finish up, because again, I think have a great, great section on this in your book. And I want to, part of the thing that you include is a quote from veterinary behaviorist Dr. Nicholas Dodman, who's a past guest on the show. I'm just going to read a little bit of what he talks about when cats go through the clawing. He says, the inhumanity of the procedure is clearly demonstrated by the nature of cats' recovery from anesthesia following the surgery. Unlike routine recoveries, declawing surgery results in cats bouncing off the walls of the recovery cage because of excruciating pain. Cats that are more stoic huddle in the corner of the recovery cage and mobilize in a state of helplessness. Declawing fits the dictionary definition of mutilation to a T. So, again, I just think, you know, it's a little bit rough to hear maybe, but, I mean, a lot of people just don't think, you know, because, again, declawing, hey, I'm just clipping his nails, whatever. But, it is amputation. I just think we always need to kind of repeat that message here on a show like this. So
definitely amputation. And the organization you mentioned earlier, the
PAW Project?
I love their ad. You know, they have a human hand with all the joints, you know, amputated off the ends. That's exactly what it is.
Right, right. Graphic and hopefully effective. So Michelle, we've been speaking with Michelle Nagelschneider. Again, her new book is The Cat Whisperer, Why Cats Do What They Do and How to Get Them to Do What You Want. And we've been discussing only just a fraction of all the great information and strategies and stuff included in there. And she also has a whole consulting business and stuff that we've alluded to as well. And the website for that is thecatbehaviorclinic.org. So, Michelle, thank you so much for joining us on Talking Animals and all your great work and guiding us today with some of our listener questions as well.
Oh, you're so welcome. It was a pleasure. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. All right. In just a few minutes, we'll speak with Linda Hamilton, Executive Director of the Animal Coalition of Tampa, about its Spaghetti and No Balls Dinner, slated for March 30th. Let's step now into the Talking Animals Comedy Corner. This is Paula Poundstone with a relevant piece called Cats Puff Up on today's Comedy Corner on Talking Animals.
You know what I can't figure out? All my cats are indoor cats, and some of them are out-and-out fat and lazy cats. And I don't know, why they puff up when they fight with each other? You know, I know, you know, they say, oh, cats puff up so they look bigger to their adversaries. But first of all, my cats all know each other. You know what I mean? They don't really believe for a moment that one of them got really big. I mean, cats know about puffing up. That did they think it was a trick only they knew? And the other cat actually just got bigger in that moment? That doesn't make any sense. And it seems to me it must take a lot of energy to puff up. I would think that they would just have a meeting, and one day my head fat lazy cat would just turn to the others and say, look, from now on, let's nobody puff up. We already know about puffing up. We're not fooling anybody. If you puff up and I puff up, we're the same anyways. Tell you what, once a day I'm going to grab each of you with my front paws and kick at you with my back paws, and you just take it.
All right. That was Paula Poundstone with a piece called Cats Puff Up, taken from her album I Heart Jokes. Paula tells them in Maine. Okay, on the line with us now is Linda Hamilton, Executive Director of the Animal Coalition of Tampa. Welcome back, Linda.
Good morning, Duncan. How are you?
Great. Thanks for joining us again on Talking Animals. So let's just do the nickel tour of what Animal Coalition of Tampa is for folks listening who may not be familiar with it, and especially maybe a quick mention of your new digs, and then we'll get into the matter at hand.
Okay, well, when we started 2002, we'd never intended to be more than a ma and a pa, but things just kind of got out of hand. We offer high volume, high quality, at affordable prices, pet medical services. We started with a focus on spaying and neutering because our mission is to end the euthanasia that happens when pets find their way into a shelter. And we've since just kind of responded to people's requests, which has ended up us moving from 3,000 square feet to about 10,000 last October. Quite the move.
Yeah, moving on, moving on up, yeah.
It's really been an experience. We've gone to a little place to a place that's so big that you actually can get lost.
Well, yeah, but I mean, as part of that, of course, you've got to fund the operation, and again, keep the prices for all these procedures and meds low. So there's all kinds of events that you guys do throughout the year to help fund the operation.
We do, and we're getting bigger now that we have the big place. We've got some room to actually have a department that's doing this.
Yeah, but let's talk about the most imminent of those that's coming up on March 30th.
Yeah, that's our fun one. We started this as a very small group of 32 when we first got started back in 2002 with Trap, Neuter, and Return. And we got some cat ladies together, and we called it Spaghetti and No Balls Dinner and Silent Auction. Well, it developed its own following, and so now we're up to 200 to 300, and it's just kind of caught on. We thought for a while we should really kind of change the name because, you know, nobody's going to like it, but people have a lot of fun.
Yeah, it's colorful. It's a colorful name, for sure.
It is, and I always get that one phone call from that one lady who tells me I ought to be ashamed of myself.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, other than that, I find someday she might talk to me a little bit, but that's
sure.
all I've gotten so far.
Well, let me substitute for that lady. You ought to be ashamed, Linda, for the name. But so where is it taking place, and what are some of the basic details?
Yeah, we change venues every year, and this year we were invited by the Yuengling Brewery Beer Garden. They're going to treat all of our diners to a tour through the beer garden that's out on close to Busch Gardens. Yuengling Beer Garden on North 30th Street.
Yeah.
Close to Busch Gardens.
And this gets underway at 5 o'clock on Saturday, March 30th, about a week and a half from today.
Uh-huh.
And,
very busy. We're online for tickets.
Right. So we can go to actampa.org. Is that
the
best?
That's the easiest, best place to
go.
We've got a whole lot of things that are going on there, and we've got a direct link to buy your ticket.
Right.
The tickets this year have some very interesting door prices. We have a hot air balloon.
Yeah, a hot air balloon ride. Not just a hot air balloon, but a ride. Yeah.
Yeah, we've got some really interesting things going on. We've got some private photo shoots for silent auction items and a gold and necklace and Busch Garden tickets and a week stay at a Bow Wow. We've got a Bose music system.
It's great.
Donated. So we've got quite a bit going on. Home cooking this year.
Nice.
Yeah, caterers wouldn't do as good as our volunteers have done. So that group of people came back to us and said, hey, wait a minute. We can do what you had last year, but we can do it for less.
Wow, now we're talking. Well, let's just remind folks that's again, among the ways that the ACT Animal Coalition of Tampa kind of keeps the prices low on spay, neuter, and other services that they offer. So that's this week from this Saturday, March 30th, 5 to 9 p.m., Yuengling Brewery Beer Garden. And if more information is at actampa.org and how you get your tickets and the whole nine yards. So, Linda, thank you so much for all your great work and joining us again on Talking Animals.
Thank you.
All right.
Thanks.
All right. I'm Duncan Strauss. Towards the end of the show, which we're, again, rapidly approaching, we'll play Name That Animal Tune. The winner will win a copy of Michelle Nagel Schneider's book, The Cat Whisperer. That's going to be happening in just a moment or two here on Talking Animals. But let's quickly run through some animal news and announcements. A proposed horse slaughterhouse in New Mexico is just weeks away from opening, according to A.E. Blair Dunn, a lawyer for Valley Meat Company in Roswell. Rick De Los Santos, the general manager of the meat company, has told the Huffington Post that he expects the plant to be open around April 29th upon receiving approval from the USDA. Quote, everything we've heard is that everything is a go and that it should be okay, De Los Santos said. After the plant is approved, the company plans to wait a week or two before beginning to slaughter horses. Saw this driving over this morning from the LA Times. Animal rights activists on Tuesday called for criminal charges against those responsible for the death of a sled dog who was left outside in bitter cold overnight during Alaska's Iditarod. The death of a 5-year-old Dorado is the first in 4 years for the 1,049-mile annual race between Anchorage and Nome, a grueling endurance contest that has run through some of the harshest snow, ice, and wind conditions on Earth. Mentioned this the last couple of Wednesdays, but one more reminder, there's going to be a showing at a price that can't be beat of The Peaceable Kingdom, The Journey Home, the award-winning documentary we've talked about a few times on the show here on Talking Animals. That's going to be this Saturday, March 23rd at 3 p.m. at the Jan Kamenis Platt Regional Library on Manhattan Avenue in Tampa. You can find out more by going to floridavoicesforanimals.org. And also on the radio landscape locally, Bubba the Love Sponge is going vegan. Yeah, I know. He's promoting animal activist resources and, hooking this as a resource at PETA, and he has a sister cooking meals, etc. So whatever your view is of Bubba the Love Sponge, if you want to track this, you can go to him. We can search for his Facebook page and all that information and more is there. So, saw this over on my side of the state. Pure Thoughts Horse Rescue last weekend rescued 8 orphan foals aged 6 days to 2 weeks from an auction house, which it did not disclose. The foals require around-the-clock care and nutrition, which volunteers provide at its facilities on F Road. And anyway, seemed odd to say the least. All right, I think time now to play Name That Animal Tune. The winner will again receive a copy of Michelle Nagelschneider's book, The Cat Whisperer. And so you do not need to be a WNF member to win. There'll be that prize, of course. The first person that calls in the correct tune, correct title, really, at 813-239-9663. It's Name That Animal Tune. I'm talking about this.
Oh, baby, baby, let me be your loving teddy bear. Put a chain around my neck and lead me anywhere. Let me be,
oh, let him be
your teddy bear. I don't want to be a tiger, because tigers play too rough.
All right, if we get folks ready to guess, we'll take those off the air, because we have just about reached the end of today's edition of Talking Animals on WMNF Tampa. We'll be back next Wednesday, March 27th, and when, among other things, Mike Strauss will be in the house. So hope you'll join us for that. Also, visit our website, talkinganimals.net, where we have all kinds of archives, podcasts, and more, links to our Facebook page, Twitter, etc. Talking Animals broadcast outreach consultant and Jill of all trades is Libby Busolis. My thanks to her. I'm Duncan Strauss. Thanks very much for listening. Have a good week. Be kind to animals. Be kind to others. Be kind to yourself. We're closing out today's show with an animal song, of course. This is Ry Cooter with his version of Three Cool Cats. Taking us up to the NPR News on WMNF Tampa, Brandon Clearwater, Largo, Weekiwatchee, and beyond. Thanks for listening. Speaking with you again next Wednesday at 9 a.m. on Talking Animals. Thanks.